The doors opened. We were like, what's going on here? And all of a sudden, these four AK-47s came in the window. They're like, and they just started screaming at us. And we're all wrecked. So we're like, what? For instance, one day we were driving to work and there's just a dead body on the road. Nobody reports them because as soon as you report them, they become your property and you have to pay for the funeral. Second day, he was still there. Third day, he was still there. And then on the fourth day, they put a cone next to him. So nobody run him over. The pub that we were drinking in that night, someone ran in there with an AK-47 and shot the place to pieces. When I landed in Lagos, you used to have a armoured carrier pick you up from the airport and take you to the island. And I could see where I was working, but I wasn't allowed to walk there. We had to get picked up every day. There was a carjacking going on behind us. They pulled the bloke out and nearly beat him to death with a crowbar.
So we are here with another new fantastic guest, and we've got Kev Page from Pentagon.
Good afternoon.
Yeah. And Kev, we've got on, from what I can gather, you do a lot of bits and pieces on different things. So I wanted to get you on to talk about sort of your journey and to tell us how you've gone from where you were before to sort of where you are now, but not missing anything out. I know we've just had a little pre-chat about hiring staff and some of those sort of trials and tribulations that you've had. So just take me back. We like to sort of, obviously not back to when you were six and I knew that being in the trade was all I wanted to do, but, you know, sort of your time at school and then what sort of happened to progress you into sort of where you are now.
So school, bit of a nerd. Like, I did try hard at school. I did all right with my grades.
Yeah.
But when it came to after school, I thought I wanted to be a graphic designer. That is what I thought I wanted to do. Like, I used to love drawing and so on and so forth.
You'd end up like these two.
Never actually made a job out of it. But I remember I got accepted into college, and within the first 6-8 weeks, the lecturer sat us down and he's like, look, out of the 30 of you that are in this course, two of you will find work within the graphic design sphere, whatever it is. And it was like, well, I've seen what that guy's doing and he's 10 times better than me. And I looked around and I gave up, but...
Why would that, like, for me, why would any teacher say, only two of you are going to make it? If you're a teacher, you should be confident that those that are within your class are taking it for the right reasons and you can actually mentor them to get to where they need.
Well, that's the thing, like, you'd seen a portfolio work that I gave them, so I don't know if it's bums on seats sort of thing, but it's, I don't know if it's a, this is a short, sharp wake-up call of, this is what the industry is. There's all of these people going into it and the seats are very limited. I suppose.
How long ago was this?
Oof, left school, so 16.
Yeah.
So straight after that, I was like, right, that's not for me then, because I look around and these people were so talented. Like, you could just see that they had something that I didn't. And it's like, I suppose it's like people going to a football camp, you know, there's all of you turning up for football, but only two of you in this group have definitely got it. All of these people are falling by the wayside. And it was that realisation that perhaps this isn't for me. Spent a bit of time on my ass, just not really knowing what I wanted to do. Did a bit of groundworking, just kept busy. Dad's always worked. And he's like, you are not sitting at home. You get out and you work. So cue a bit of concreting, cue a bit of anything really, just busy. And then it was a case of CITB were in the local college. So I was the next year's intake because obviously I'd missed a year because I'd gone to six or eight weeks of trying to be a graphic designer. And so I went to CITB, thought I wanted to be a company. Like, my dad had always done, he used to be a local DJ, he used to make all his own kit. So I'd always been around it. My granddad was a plumbing heating engineer that used to design systems to go in NHS hospitals. So as he used to tell me, I was just going to be a disappointed fitter because I was going to be a carpenter or a plumber with his head smashed out. And I don't know, it was just something that having an end product at the end of it, and it, I went and did the test and, went and become a carpentry apprentice for a job in builder. He specialised in loft conversions.
Okay.
So you do pretty much everything. It's all woodwork. Yeah. So it was great.
How long was that for?
So he hired me for about a year, and after the first 7 weeks, he was leaving me on my own to do stuff. And then the first year came to an end, and he was like, I can't afford to pay you £100 a week. And I'm like, £100 a week? And like, he's leaving me, I'm in charge of two other apprentices. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you just want the cheap labour. That's
So this is another bone of contention on here, because we have people that come on that do hire apprentices, and they're sort of like, well, we have to pay for absolutely everything, and the money that we do actually get in sort of form from the government doesn't even cover a fraction of it. Obviously, it's probably very different now with inflation and whatever else and the cost of everything. But I feel like some people as well, when they're pricing jobs, I feel like if you can't afford to pay £100 per week to an apprentice, then you're underpricing a job.
Mm.
And surely if you've got somebody there and they're already after 7 weeks looking after jobs for you, surely in your mind as a boss anywhere, you'd be thinking, right, okay, every job if I do five jobs a week, I need to add on this amount of money to cover that.
Yeah.
So it boggles my mind that some people they do this and then.
Oh, don't get me wrong. It was a strange apprenticeship, because he used to run. He used to have his own rare breeds of cattle. So one day I went to work and he's like, right, today we're going to put hay in the fields. We're going to round up the cows. I was like, I didn't realise I needed to put a bull whip in this morning. It was bizarre. But as it happened, when he said I can only give you £100 a week, CRTB. Obviously, I haven't been involved with them for a long time, but they found me another job pretty much straight away, and it was £300 a week. I was like, what's going on here? So then I went site bashing for the rest of my apprenticeship, which I think everybody should do, because it teaches you how to earn money. It's easy. It's a box. You get a new box to put new stuff in. There's not a great deal of figuring out what can go wrong in there. It's new. Although if you see a lot of the stuff online with new builds these days, that don't mean nothing.
Yeah, there's a few, I think it's new build home quality, isn't it? That we've had on. It's like absolutely shocking. you see the state of some of the work that people do on there.
Yeah. And and I think everybody should do it, because if you're always on day rate, it doesn't make you want to work any harder. But when you learn, you can earn good money through working a little bit harder, working a little bit longer, then it teaches you to appreciate, like, right, get your ducks in a row. This is what you need to get done today. And if you get that done,
organises you better.
Yeah. And also, you can get to Friday. I mean, I don't really do half days anymore, but we used to get to Friday and we'd be going home at 11 o'clock because we'd made our money.
Yeah.
And we'd be up for, we'd be ready for next week. And then about the time I finished that, I had quite a bad car crash, and it laid me up for a while. And then all of a sudden, there's somebody else working on my site, and it's like it completely and utterly knocked me. I was like, maybe I'm not. This isn't what I'm cut out to be, because all of a sudden I was.
I mean, how long were you out for then with the
car? Only probably about 6 weeks. But because it was a small house builder, they were always on about turning over. It was always on about we need to get the houses built. And as an apprenticeship, we did everything. So we did the first fix, we did the second fix. And it was brilliant, because you got to see it all. Like, and you're on a building site, so you're seeing it all go up. Like, you're seeing the footings getting dug, and then all of a sudden, as you're getting further down the site, you're going back and going to do third fix. So you're seeing everything all the way through. And that's, I think, as a chippy, you do see all of the processes, or you're involved with them in some way, shape or form. Again, it sort of put me in good stead later on, because I got a job working as a boat builder for high-end yachts, which is strange because it's landlocked. Like, we're in the middle of the country and there was a boatyard. So I did that for a couple of years working on it.
So when you had the car accident, did you leave the other job?
Yeah, so it was because I was self-employed. All of a sudden, there was no money coming in, and I need a wage. And then that pushed me back to having that comfort blanket of getting a constant wage. And like I said, it sort of knocked me a bit, because at the time you're young, you're still trying to figure out some. I mean, most chippies are arrogant anyway, but it was a case that. Maybe this isn't what I'm cut out to be. If he can find somebody that quickly, to fill that void, what am I going to do? And it, to be fair, that was all I'd ever known up to that point, apart from that guy that told me I weren't worth £100 a week. So yeah, I went building yachts, and it was just like a as wonderful as the work looked at the end. It was just a great, basically like just turning out the same thing. Mm. Every 4 weeks you were doing the same thing.
Where was that base? Was that not far from where
that was just outside Peterborough, so yeah. Literally right in pretty much in the middle of the country. Mm. Which was weird, but we used to send them down to Ipswich to get tested. And then the sort of the financial crisis hit.
2008.
Like, yeah, so it was like, what's pretty not...
Well, nobody's going to be buying boats.
Well, this is the thing, though. Like, people want to buy them, but the banks weren't releasing the money. Mm. So they were like, no, we're not getting rid of any of these at the moment. So all of a sudden I was like, I need to get out of here and I need to find something that is pretty much recession-proof. So I went lecturing for a couple of years, but that was difficult. It was very difficult.
Were you lecturing for carpentry?
Yeah. Okay. So and
well, you're the first. Is it the first lecturer that we've had on?
I was young. I was young as well, and that was one of my main issues with it. I looked around and there was another lad that was probably about the same age as me, but I was young and I hadn't had kids, and like kids do change your ways about how you view certain
life.
So it completely changes it. And I just remember being I'll skip over it because it wasn't great, but I used to get to teach kids that weren't, they'd sort of been put aside from mainstream school. They weren't
a bit naughty.
I don't know what the most PC way of putting it is, but but they were brilliant to teach. Brilliant. And they had the right attitude. They just, because it was something different, it was something that all the other kids weren't doing. They'd come up and they'd make their own tables, they make stuff to take back to their parents. One of them, he was with me, and you never really knew why they were there. But one of the lads was like, yeah, he burnt down a care home. I was like, all right. But yeah, it was, but again, he was brilliant. He would have been a good chippy. Just not around too much sawdust, obviously. And I wasn't enjoying it. And I'd sort
of... So what didn't you like about the lecturing? Was it just...
We can talk about the education system a lot until the cows come home. But one of the things was like, one lad, he'd come through all of the tests and I sat there and we were doing basic joints. Like, just get the hand skills to somewhere where they need to be. And I said to him, what's half of 22? And he was like, I don't know.
I mean, that's the thing for me, that I feel that the system sort of lets everything down, because some of these people, like, I mean, Richard Branson, dyslexic, struggled to read and write, you know, and obviously he's made something of himself. But yeah. I feel like those are people that get lost in the system, and it's sort of up to you to help try and fix it. But then the stuff that's gone on before, if they'd have arrived at yours and could actually do that, you could probably do something with it. And it's just, I feel like a lot of kids just, you know, they don't fit the system. So they get tossed to one side, and then it's sort of like, oh, well, there you know. But why isn't somebody saying, look, well, your maths isn't great, so what else can we push you into where you're not having to do measurements or calculations or something like that we can actually help you with, or we have to push you through here first to make sure you qualify for that?
Yeah.
Ladies and gents, just a quick one to say a huge thank you to our new headline sponsor, CT1, the best sealants on the market, voted for by the British public. Not only that, it's made in Britain as well. So go and support a product and a brand that is made in the UK. But I just want to say to you, they've got a brand new product out, which is the BT1. It's a combination sealant and adhesive like the popular CT1, but it's perfect for keeping a hygienic environment. And it's designed to completely stop the growth of bacteria, microbes, and fungus. And not only that, this stuff is strong. Now, it's going to be available at Travis Perkins, Wicks, Juicens, and pretty much everywhere else, so there's no excuse not to go and give it a go. So we're really happy to be partnering with CT1.
You'll see people that probably struggled academically at school, but when they found something that they know, like, for instance, I've met electricians that can't read or write, but they can wire up, and all they need to do is get someone to fill the paper out for them.
Yeah. I mean, when you were at school then, did you... Did you ever have it offered to you to go into a trade? Because I've talked about this many times, and I would say probably 95% of all of the guests, there's probably only been about 5% where they've actually been offered or told, well, you can go to this specialised college that specialises in carpentry, plumbing, electrical. There's no, like, at my school, it was just literally, if you're not very academic, you go into the army.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the way that it was pushed. But I don't know about, like, when you were younger, did you have any guidance on that side of things?
No. So it's, like, because I got quite good grades. My granddad wanted me, he was a JP, and he wanted me to go into law. And not, I could not imagine myself at the university. It's like, I don't want to be, I'll be dead within a week, because I just left to my own devices in somewhere like that. I need
structure.
Yeah, I do. And I think at that point in my life, I wasn't mature enough to be able to just be chucked left on my own. Yeah. And it got to my A levels. I was like, but what do I want to do? Who knows what they want to do at 16? Mm. You're very lucky if you do.
I think there's very few people, you know, like if you've always wanted to be a doctor or a surgeon or a solicitor, there are those very, very rare, I'll probably again say maybe 10% max know what they want to do. I mean, until I sort of probably hit about 22, 23, I had no idea. I just knew I wanted to do something in business.
Yeah.
But it's trying to figure out what that is, because, you know, business could be anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'll definitely feel you on that point, that not many people know what they want to go into.
No, and you get people coming to a certain age. Like, I don't know about the other guys that have been on, but you'll see guys on site that they're probably in their 50s and a lot. I just thought I'd try being an ex. I've been a computer programmer for so many years, and I just didn't fancy it anymore. I've just had enough.
And we had Bobby to Chippy Mark, didn't we? And he was a police officer, and he just said, I'd had enough.
When I was at the Foreign Office, they had an intake of apprentices every year, and there was never anybody that was, they'd have some young people, and then I think one year there was a guy that was in his 50s and he was an apprentice, but because the apprenticeship was so good, I think he'd been in the RAF, and then he'd been at the post office for a bit, and then I was like, do you know what, I want to go and do that, because the apprenticeship was phenomenal. And then I got a phone call from a guy I used to work with at the yacht fitting firm while I was teaching. I was sort of serving notice anyway, and he was like, I've moved out to South Korea. Do you fancy coming to build a yacht? And this was on a Wednesday, and I was on the plane on the Saturday. I was like, I'm off. When I was an apprentice, I got offered the opportunity to go out to Canada and start to learn how to build flat pack houses, because the guy who was there, his uncle, started up a business and wanted to bring it over here. And I turned it down because I was like, no, I want to get my apprenticeship done, and being very sensible about it all. And, you know, it just got to the point where I was like, oh, fuck it, I'm off. I'm going. I was at the start of a very fledgling relationship at that time as well. But I got out there, and it completely blew my mind. I was like, I want to travel. This is what I want to do. Mm. And strangely enough, just before I went,
Whereabouts did you go, South Korea?
Busan, on the south coast.
I know where it is, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful country, beautiful. The people were so nice. The culture out there was just like, right, we're going to work hard, and then afterwards we're just going to go get wrecked.
Yeah.
And every night.
Nice people, the Koreans.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. Like, it was, and it just blew my mind, you don't just have to sit around where, like, there's guys that I worked with that have never worked outside of Peterborough. They've never travelled further than that. It's like, I find that weird, but they find it weird that I've done the opposite. But while I was out in Korea, just before I went to Korea, I had an interview for a company in, strangely enough, my town. They used to fit bombproof windows in embassies overseas, and I was just waiting for my clearance to come through. So I went out to Korea for about 3 months, just building this yacht, and I was working 20-hour days. I was going grey because I was just waking up. I was sleeping there, just waking up, putting some furniture together, and then going back to sleep again. And every now and again, because they were trying to grab the land back, they'd be setting dynamite. Yeah. So every couple of hours, you just go, boom, you're like, oh, go back to work then. And it was like 48 degrees, and it just, the culture, everything, I was like, I fancy a bit of this. And they offered for me to stay out there. They were like, we want you to stay out here. We want you to... I met the premier of South Korea. He was just walking around. There was all of a sudden, there was all these black suits. Everyone was like, what the bloody hell's going on here? And then all of a sudden, this guy came around, shook my hand. He's like, thanks for coming. And he's off again. I was like, who's that guy? And it was their premier or whoever it was. And I was, oh, okay. And then I just got back to sanding because, you know, I had a little better to do. But it was, I phoned up the company that was in the UK and I was like, look, if there's not a job offer there, where do I stand? And they're like, yeah, we're just waiting for your clearance to come through because it was obviously working in sensitive areas. So we had to have clearance. And I came back for that. And also, I really have to say this is for my now wife. It was very fledgling relationship, but it was like, yeah, I think there's probably some legs in this. So came back and started working.
She didn't fancy Korea.
I did offer. Like, because the guy I was working for, he's like, look, we'll bring her out here, we'll do X, Y, and Z. I said to her, like, we're in the middle of nowhere, no one speaks a jot of English. Like, but yeah, so came back and then got a job doing. It was a very strange job. Like when we're in the UK, we did shop fitting. And then when we were overseas, we fit. It was a bit refurbishment, bomb-proof windows. So I was only there for about 6 weeks, and they were like, right, do you want to go to Lagos? I was like, Portugal? They went, Nigeria. I was like, yeah, all right. So I spent 6 weeks out in Lagos. And then we spent quite a bit of time in Africa, actually. That was eye-opening, really eye-opening. Because I'd be away for a lot, especially when I joined the Foreign Office, I'd be away for like 9 months of the year. I'll get back. The dog would look at me as if to say, you ain't sitting there. And it's just, you come back and you try and fit so much into a short space of time because you're trying to see the family, trying to see your friends. All of a sudden you're away again. And then you just lose contact with everybody because they just assume that you're never in the country. And it's like, but yeah, it was 1 year I did 14 countries in 1 year. And it was, yeah, it was a real good time.
So were you fitting bomb-proof windows then for embassies, were you always?
Yeah, so I remember one time we went to fit some anti-bandit glass in like all of the residences out in Lagos.
Yeah.
And one of the things you had to do is you had to lean against the glass while the other guy was siliconing up on the inside. But he was on the inside of the shelter and I was on the outside. And it was this rough part of Lagos. And I just remember leaning against this window and all of a sudden, one guy poked his head round down the street, poked his head round the corner, he went back round. And I was like, look at this. I looked at the guy back through the window, I was like, hurry up. I looked down the street again, and then all of a sudden, 10 of them come running around the corner. I was like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And they're getting closer and closer. And all of a sudden, he's like, all right, because he can't see what's going on. He's like, he's like, stop shaking the window. And I was like, hurry up, hurry up, just get in. And all of a sudden, like, the door slid open and I just shot in and then they just came to the window and he was like, oh, that's what was wrong, was it?
So where are you then currently with the stuff that you're doing? What are you sort of up to now then? Because you've gone and done the boat building, you've done lecturing, bomb-proof windows.
Yeah.
How did you end up back here and then sort of what you're doing now? How did that sort of like evolve? Because if you're onto a good gig. Was it just you thought, I want to spend more time at home? What is...
So what happened was I was out in Abu Dhabi and my wife was pregnant with a son. And I got a phone call and I was like, she's like, Kev, something's wrong. I was like, right. I'm a 9-hour flight away. What? I was like, right. She's like, you've got to come home. And all of a sudden that was it. Everything changed. And fair play to the project manager, like, I'll get you on the next flight. But it still wasn't quick enough. Fortunately, everything was fine. But it just, my mindset completely changed. Because when I was overseas, I was there to work. That was it. It was very easy to take my brain out. And it wasn't fair, but it was how I dealt with it. And I came back and worked fantastic. They were like, right, what we'll do is we'll keep you home based. So I went into the office and then I started pricing work. So I'd do all the takeoffs. I'd go into meetings with designers and that kept me at home. And then I got used to being at home. We all got used to spending time together. And then I went estimating for construction projects. So I worked for a shop fitting firm Then I worked for a consultancy firm. And one day, it was, I can't remember what it was, but it was, we basically it was a chat between the firm and a contractor, and it was, how do we push some cost? What can we, how do we word it so that we don't have to carry the can for that mistake? I was like, I don't like this. I've been that contractor.
Mm.
And I was like, I don't want any part of this anymore. And there was always an itch that I needed to get back and go back on the tools, because it's what I enjoy doing. It's genuinely where I remain happy. I can't sit at a computer for too long.
Mm.
I mean, when lockdown was on, I was drinking 15 cups of tea a day, because I can't sit down. I have to get, I mean, it probably got to a point where one was feeding the other. I can't sit down because I've got too much caffeine. But yeah, it just, I got to the point where I was like, I need to go back. I need to get out of this. I can't be doing with it. So I got offered an opportunity by a local, just a small builder. He's like, I've got 6 months worth of work for you. I was like, I'm going. And that was it. I just went back on the tools. So, I'll tell you the same as I tell anybody else. Because I've got quite a lot of things that I can do, shop fitting, et cetera, I just do whatever makes me money. For instance, some of the stuff that's online, I've gone in to fit one length of skirting, and that's turned into 8 wardrobes, a set of stairs, load of panelling. But at the start, I'm very risk averse. I've always been risk averse. But it's got to the point now where I was always worrying that if I didn't have 2 months, 3 months worth of work, I'd be worried. But now, if it's not that, I'm not so bothered, because stuff comes in, stuff happens. I still subby for small carpentry firms and that. I just got bored of being in an office.
Mm.
It's not where I want to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, and like I say, I enjoy my job. Like, I'm lucky because I do enjoy my job.
Yeah. What's been the highlight then of your career, would you say, so far?
I spent the summer of the 2014 World Cup in Colombia, when Colombia had a really good run in the World Cup. It was amazing.
Was that for the Foreign Office as well?
Yeah. So I was out there, and it was just, I've gone out there to relieve somebody else, and it was, the atmosphere was amazing. You hear all these horror stories, like I turned up, and then I was supposed to have been given this wonderful escort, and all of a sudden I just turned up, not escort like that, but taxi service. I was supposed to have had the number plate, the picture of the driver, and then all of a sudden I turned up, shit, there's nobody in the office because it's 3 o'clock in the morning, where's my taxi? And there was just this banger in the corner. I was like, oh shit, that's my taxi, innit? And we were going through this, I don't know if you can say shantytown, favelas or whatever it was. And I was like, I'm not going home.
Mm.
So I'm not going home. But yeah, amazing place. Like, it just, the whole place was just rocking. It was an amazing time to be out there. I mean, they did stop serving alcohol on the day, because apparently the first time that Colombia won, there was like loads of murders and loads of so, right, we're going to stop giving people alcohol now. But I was like, what happens if they lose? Oh, shit. But yeah, it was brilliant. It was, yeah, I've been very, very lucky that I've sort of, it's not serendipity as such, but I've just sort of fell into a different role where it's benefited me in some way, shape or form, whereas some people aren't that lucky. I do know I'm lucky.
So you'd recommend the travel if you get to do with work?
And this is going to sound really bad, but it's either you do it early or you do it late, possibly after a divorce, because people, like,
you can't keep a wife happy at home if you...
Well, it depends on how you get on. You probably get, because the strange thing was, when I stopped travelling, my wife was like, be interesting to see how we get on, won't it? It's like, shit, yeah, probably will be, actually, because we'd never spent huge amounts of time together, because I'd always been travelling, whether it be Monday to Friday or...
Now she's asking you to go back to Colombia.
I just remember one time, like, we'd had this big chat that I needed to stay at home more, and she's like, I've been in and out of work with my manager, because any time there was a job come up, I'd be like, yeah, I'll do it. I'll always do it. I've been in and out of chat with the manager, and I'd said, look, I'm travelling too much. Can you knock it back? Literally, as I walked out, I got a phone call from my wife. She's like, I've just been made redundant. I literally turned around straight back in and went, have you got any jobs? Mm. Not overseas, because you still got mortgages to pay.
Yeah,
so yeah. Yeah, very fortunate. She was very understanding like that, because either that or she just didn't want me around too much.
No.
But yeah, that is a
big heart.
The opportunity that I've been afforded to be able to go and travel and do my job. Yeah, big thing.
Here's a question for you. If you weren't a chippy, what are the trade interests you?
Yeah, stonemasonry. I mean, there's always going to be a need for it because it's such a niche thing. But plumbing and electrics doesn't interest. I steer away from it. If there's a current running through it in any way, shape or form, I don't want nothing to do with it because I think I don't like the idea that people are becoming these multi-trades. Okay, that's fine. That's brilliant. Mm. But I think stuff like that, they have to be specialised. Because the days of, oh, Dave will do that because he's got a set of screwdrivers.
Yeah, you're messing around with.
Yeah, and all the insurances, like insurance companies are easily taking any excuse to walk away from something that they have to pay out, they'll use it. So, I don't know.
Mine is online. I watch, there's a guy who cleans pools called the Pool Guy.
Yeah.
So I watch him. The new build home quality control guys, always watch theirs.
Picking up on other people's faults.
I find it interesting as to what somebody's thinking when they've left something like that. So I always like the psychology side of it. But also the other one is there's a guy who does thatch roofs and stuff like that. Stuff that's slightly obscure where it's not plumbing, electrical or whatever. I quite like.
Yeah.
Even people jet washing drives and landscapers. I'd probably be, if I was a trader, I'd probably want to be a landscaper, I think.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't have to lay in some slabs, porcelain slabs.
But in the summer, you always look at a gardener and go, what a job that is. Mm. And then in the winter, they're like, what a horrible job that is.
Yeah, only for 6 months of the year.
Yeah. But I think we, as chippies, you can do a lot of it. Weather has been a big thing this past 6 months in, like, the amount of brickies brickies are saying, I've not had a full week in months. Mm. Whereas we can do inside, outside. I think because I've done it for so long, and like if there's something that bugs me that I don't know about my trade, I'll learn it. I'll either sit at home watching YouTube videos or get a book out. I've still got my old like apprenticeship books because, you know, you'll come across stuff that you haven't seen for years, and it's all of a sudden like, oh shit, that's what it is. It's almost got to the point where it's sad because my job has almost become a part of me, and it's like, my younger self, I was like, I remember saying to my parents, if you buy me a tool for Christmas, it's like going to work on Christmas Day, and I do not want anything to do with it. And I'm like, new hammer.
Yeah, but that's like getting bought a box of shorts, you know, like, when you're younger, you don't appreciate it, then when you get older, you think, thank God somebody's bought me them, because I'm going to buy them myself. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, leave us with your final thought then for somebody else entering the trade or somebody that's sort of a bit disillusioned with what they're doing. What would you say to somebody like that?
It is literally for everybody. Like there is something there for everybody. And you get to work with such a broad range of people. And if you're young and wanting to get into the trade, do it, because there's all this worry about what the future is going to hold. There's always going to be houses being built. There's always going to be people wanting stuff being refurbished. And there's always going to be stuff that needs fixing. And who's going to be able to do that? And unfortunately, I think there's a stat where for every 7 guys leaving the trade, there's only 1 guy coming back into it. So
it's a golden era.
Yeah, so you're going to get to a point where they did it a few years ago with plumbers where there wasn't any plumbers. So they were charging a fortune. Everyone's like, I want to be a plumber because they're charging a fortune. Mm. But I think that's happening with all trades now, that people do not have the expertise, or they're being pushed into a certain way. Like, you have to be a first fix chippy, you have to be a second fix chippy or whatever. And the expertise isn't there. And the guys that were teaching, they're leaving in their droves, because I know I can't do my job forever because my body won't let me. Mm. But
would you go back to lecturing then?
I think I would now. Like
your mindset.
Yeah, it's completely changed, especially having kids. It completely changes it. It completely changes everything about you. I've personally found it gives you a different perspective on what you want from life. And lecturing, I would go back now. I, I was very honest with myself with lecturing. I was like, I'm too young to be doing this. I don't know it. I haven't lived it all. I haven't done enough to be able to tell, although I've been 10 years deep or whatever it was, I hadn't done enough to tell them
what this is.
Yeah. And it's, and also there's that you're very close to them in age, and it's, they, you could see the way that they look at the older guys and be like, I'm going to listen to him because obviously he's done more because he's older, even though he'd probably been teaching for 30 years and he'd been off the tools for longer. But yeah, it's, I think trade is, it doesn't matter who you are. It's for everybody. And I think that's the beauty of being in the trade.
Are you wasting time? I think that some of you probably are, and I have a solution for you. Nobody wants to do any type of admin. Now, I have a solution for you, and it is called Tradeify. It's a fully automated job scheduling, invoicing, and quoting all in one place. Now, that software is going to save you 12 hours a week, and all by using a simple software solution. Now, you can try it for 2 weeks, absolutely free, no cards needed, and you'll even get support in person from Tradeify themselves. Now, when you're done, you can always come back to me and thank me, but just enjoy the extra 12 hours that you're going to gain from just using the software.
That was good, man.
I really enjoyed that.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Those travel stories.
We were topping out on a job. We got sent over to, where was it? Mali, before it went to shit. And I just remember there was me, a lad, and these two Sparkies. And they were like, we were topping out because we'd done what we needed to do. We're like, fuck it, let's go out, let's have a good time. And we went out and we went to this bar, and it was owned by dodgy bloke, and we come back, we're all fucking wrecked, and there was only one road into the hotel, and it was a 5-star, it fucking weren't, it was like a 2. But we went round into the hotel, and just as we got round, there was me, the two spark, I was between the two Sparkies, and there was my gaffer at the time in the front. All of a sudden the taxi stopped, it was this beat up old fucking Civic, and it had a goat in the back of it. It was fucking horrible. Yeah. And the doors opened. We were like, what the fuck's going on here? And all of a sudden, these four AK-47s came in the window. They're like, and they just started screaming at us. And we're all wrecked. So we're like, what? And all of a sudden, the fucking Sparky next to me went, I don't get paid enough for this. I went another £3 an hour. I was like, you want £3 an hour to get a fucking... And, like, and all of a sudden, it calmed down, and they went, money? I was like, come on, lads, get your wallets out. So we all got our wallets out, and we fucking threw, it was like 12 quid or something. But the doors closed, and that was it, we were off. Mm. And we're all shaking like a shitting dog the following day. We're like, did that really happen last night?
Mm.
And yeah, it was...
I had an experience like that in China where the taxi driver was driving me, and I was thinking, hold on a minute. Going completely the opposite direction. Obviously got my phone out and luckily managed to, because it's so difficult when you're over there to try and get like some extra data where you can open it up.
Yeah.
Managed to get on, and I was like, he's fucking going miles away. And obviously I said, which way are you going? Ignored me. Carried on like this for a bit. And in the end, I started bashing on the back of the fucking seat and ended up turfing me out on this motorway that was about 40 miles from where I was supposed to be going. They were driving me out of the city. And fucking I had to flag somebody down to... in fucking China. And I was like, you know, thinking, like, if I hadn't have clocked it,
yeah,
it would have just been, took me somewhere, probably robbed all my shit and just left me walking around somewhere.
The thing that always stuck with me is that was the poverty, like, especially in Africa. Like, we stopped in one place, and the Sparky, he'd siliconed up everywhere, and he didn't have a rag, so he'd used his t-shirt, so he wiped it, put his t-shirt, thrown his t-shirt, screwed it up and put it in the skip.
Somebody took it out.
We got there the following morning. The security guy's walking around like this because his fucking t-shirt's all screwed up with silicone. He's got the t-shirt on. And we're like, let's go and get him a t-shirt because that's not on. So we give him a t-shirt each. But it's the strange thing is you'd think to yourself.
Well, you think like probably the time you were doing it, like 2008, you're thinking, I can't believe people in this day and age are, you know,
yeah. And you think to yourself, oh, I'm so thankful for what I got. Mm. And then you get back home, you're like, fuck me, £3 for a cup of tea. Yeah, so,
yeah. Well, we all moan about it here.
Yeah.
But actually.
No, and it just, it was strange to see certain places. It was just,
But
yeah,
Marley Place is the most dangerous place.
No, because at the time it was all right, but I think it went to shit about 3 months after we were there. Like the pub that we were drinking in that night, someone ran in there with an AK-47 and shot the place to pieces. But Lagos, when I landed in Lagos, you used to have a armored carrier pick you up from the airport and take you to the island, and I could see where I was working, but I couldn't walk there. I could physically see it was a 100-meter walk, but I wasn't allowed to walk there. We had to get picked up every day.
It's not bad. You couldn't walk that little distance.
Yeah, and it obviously, fingers crossed, it's changed now. But it was, yeah, that out there was mind blowing. I've always lived in the same little shitty village, and you think things are bad there, but when you go somewhere like that, we were driving to work one day, and there was a carjacking going on behind us. They pulled the bloke out and nearly beat him to death with a crowbar. And then I had to hire a crane while I was out there, and I went onto the mainland, and I had to go with an armed guard to go and hire a crane. It was bizarre.
Did they not put you off going to these areas thinking I might not come back to a degree?
Nah, because I don't think that much. I wasn't thinking that much. I just had a job to do, and I was out there to do it, and I had an armed guard there, but it was... Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah, it didn't really sink in until you think about it, and then all of a sudden you're like, shit. Yeah, that actually happened. Like one day, our driver, he knocked some guy's wing mirror down come the window. He's pointing a gun at us. We'd been out the night before, and the guy in front of me is like, don't look out the window. Whatever you do, don't look out the window. Oh, shit. So, I was like, drive. But Yeah, but like for instance, one day we were driving to work and there's just a dead body on the road, and nobody reports them, because as soon as you report them, they become your property and you have to pay for the funeral. So what they did was, second day he was still there, third day
roadkill almost, just like a badger or a rabbit.
Yeah, he was still there, and then on the fourth day they put a cone next to him so nobody would fucking run him over. Yeah, other than that, we were always pretty safe. Yeah, fantastic experience. And I've had so many people ask, like, strangely, I've had quite a few of my friends' kids ask me about going into the trade, and they're all like, I want to be a chippy. And I always steer them, go, like, this is the apprenticeship for you. Do the Foreign Office apprenticeship. It's amazing. Just do it. If you can get onto it, just do it, because they pay for your first two years in college, and then all of a sudden you're travelling all over the world. Brilliant.
This is what I was talking about earlier, is I feel like a lot of people get pushed to go to uni.
Yeah.
You rack up a load of debt, and then actually there are places where they'll pay for your studying or for your job to get trained, which I feel like nobody ever pushes you into that sort of route.
No, and I don't know if it's a government-run thing, like pushing everybody into uni and get them in... like loads of debt.
I just feel like it's the schools, because again, like schools should be, for me, vocational. So you've got something where you can learn a trade for those that aren't academic, and actually you get assessed on those skills as opposed to your, you know, like certain things with the education system. If you're an A-star student, I just feel you're very good at remembering what somebody's told you.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You're just regurgitating information from a textbook. Actually, if you're good at vocational, you're working off your own instinct and your own intuition to actually build something. Yes, okay, somebody can show you, but eventually you are doing it in your own way.
Yeah, and I've come across a few brickies that they just say, oh, he's a line monkey. He's a line monkey. That's all he'll ever do. But he's got a fucking good earning being a line monkey, because he's good at it. He's quick at it. Well, if you're a sight brickie, that all they want is volume. They don't want you to be able to think. You're a dream to some. Bricky Baron, isn't you? Because you're just turfing out a load of thousands of bricks, and he's happy. Your work's good,
I definitely feel school should be split down the middle, and you've got academia on one side and sort of
the practical stuff.
Like, you know, like we do art and stuff like that at school, but it's like, was design technology really pushed as a GCSE that hard? You know, you're sort of told, are we going to need IT? Should be doing IT. I mean, you're going to need French. And this isn't sort of discouraging people to learn languages, because I think that's another thing that, again, in England, we're so blessed that everybody speaks English. But that, actually, you know, learning a language should be pushed more for us, because you can go and work anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
But again, if you've got these, you could pretty much, apart from a few standards that you'd have to relearn and slightly retrain in, you can go anywhere in the world.
Yeah, and that's what I want to get across. Like, you can do, it can take you anywhere, and there's always going to be, whenever there's Canada are looking for jobs, New Zealand looking for jobs, they're always looking for trades. Yeah. Trades and teachers, they're the big things that they're always looking for. And let it take you all over the world, you know, experience it, because unless you want to be like people that I used to work with that just want to work 3 miles. One bloke, he'd never actually physically been outside of a 7 mile radius his whole life, and he was 55. Mm. He'd never had a passport. He's like, I don't need to. Yeah. What do I need to?
I used to think, because I used to go on holidays all the time with my parents, I used to think everybody did. Mm. And then you meet people that had never been on an aeroplane until they were 24. And I feel it's those experiences, actually, especially when you experience a different culture like the Koreans or the Japanese, that are very honourable people.
Yeah. I just remember speaking to one of the lads, and he was like, they were going through their timesheets. And I was like, so do you get paid more for the more hours you work? And they're like, no. And they were bragging at each other, I've done more hours than you. And they're like, no, we don't get paid any more for it. It was just their...
Expected, yeah.
Yeah. And they were fine with it. And that to me was like, it's you only do stuff if you're going to get paid for it. Again, that's being very mercenary, but that's what being a house basher teaches you. You know, you don't, if it ain't earning your money, you don't do it. Mm. Or you do it very quickly and get on to something that will earn your money. But yeah, I just hate the way that schools just seem to push everyone down at this academic route, and it's people are miserable.
But that's why, you know, now they're saying, I think it's 9 million economically inactive people. Whereas if people had a job that they actually enjoyed, which probably, I'm not saying all of them would enjoy being on the tools or doing something like vocational, but I honestly think, you know, a great number of them would if they knew how to get involved in it all.
Is it something like the 18, a guy I was talking to yesterday, the 18 to 25, something like 35%, they're not active, they're not economically active, and they're not thinking about turning it, being active either. They're quite happy, doing nothing.
This is where, you know, if people are living longer, you've got nobody who's going to end up looking after people living longer. I just think, from my thing, if you say you go to uni, and it's funny because I put this exact reel out earlier, if you go to uni, you get saddled with a load of debt. Everything's expensive when you come out. Say if your vocation is quite a niche one, and I don't know, it's digital marketing or something, and you want to work for a big company, normally it's in London.
Yep.
Then you've got rental prices, then you've got insurance, then you've got a car, ULEZ, tube, maybe bus, whatever it is, your food's more expensive, to go out for a drink's more expensive. You know, everything's an expense, and you then got to pay back a student loan, which currently I think the interest on one of them is about 7%. So theoretically, even though you're paying it down each month because it's coming out of your wage, you're just tickling the interest. You're not actually ever paying it off.
So you basically got a second mortgage.
So people are looking at it now and thinking, well, what's the fucking point?
Yeah. And I think everyone's getting to the point now where, all right, if I go to university, I'm not guaranteed a job. Mm. Not saying that if you do an apprenticeship, you are guaranteed a job, but it makes
much
you...
better chance.
Yeah. And... With a whole university degree, okay, you've been educated to that level, but if it's niche, brilliant. If you can find something in that, it's like, I think one of my friend's kids, they want to be a museum curator. Mm. How niche is that? Mm. Is literally dead man's shoes, isn't it?
Didn't even realise it was a thing. It doesn't matter what, like, even if like people take the piss out of like shelf stacking. Probably one of the best jobs I've ever had, because I had a great social life. So I just think I'd be doing anything, whether it was cleaning a toilet or, like, you know, anything.
Yeah. There's this whole social, everything obviously looks better on social media. Everyone's always going to be a CEO of something, aren't they? And it's there's this push that everyone's got to be the top of whatever they're doing, and people are embarrassed at the job. I've done stuff like that, and it's you know, at the end of the day, everyone's got bills to pay, but for some reason, I don't understand it. Do these people not have bills to pay? That's the bit I don't get. Do they not have bills to pay, or do they not want something better in their life than just sitting at home doing nothing?
But I think some of these people where it's frowned upon to do certain things, some of the people that are doing the frowning down actually are in a scenario where you earn more, but your lifestyle costs you more. So actually, you've got nothing in the bank either. So what's the point in earning, say, 100,000, and actually at the end of each month, you've got still 200-300 quid in your account?
Yeah.
What's the point? Makes no difference. You may as well go and earn 20,000 and still have £300 a month in you.
But then I've worked around people's houses and they're worth millions and they're miserable as shit. Yeah. Oh man, what's going to make you happy?